The Local Code podcast is hosted by Ramesh Gudnawadna, architectural educator, and Renee Vamuen at the University of Western Australia. We're both directors of the company Felix Laboratories. The Local Code podcast has been brought to you by Sologain. Sologain has been in operation for over 20 years now. When you're looking for solar, go with someone who stands that test of time. Call today on 1300 739355 or simply go to their website, solargain.com.au.
Welcome everyone to the first episode of Local Code, and we're starting this podcast with a view that we want to look at climate change from a variety of perspectives. And so we're hoping to talk to people from all walks of life. Obviously, our primary audience is people in the built environment industries, but that includes policymakers and citizens, householders, developers, all of the people that might have some perspective. And we want to discuss how that works. And today we're going to talk up to three architects, and our focus is a little bit on the profession itself. And we have with us three very interesting people with quite different perspectives. Ross Donaldson, who's the former global director of Woods Bagot, is that the right word, global director?
Managing director.
CEO. But also a Perth boy. And we won't talk about his schooling background in light of current events, but we've also got Fernando Jerez, who's a director of a very successful competition-winning small practice, SMA, and a lecturer at the associate professor at UWA School of Design. And we have Emily Van Eyck, who's a teacher at UWA School of Design, but also a principal of small firm, Mount and Ike. Is that the right name of the firm?
Mount Ike.
Sorry. Yeah, good. And so we're going to start, I think we can start with you, say, Emily. Whether or not we've framed these set questions, but the words sustainability and greenness in architecture have been around even from Ross's and my time. But do you think that as a profession that we know what this really is at a practical level, and are we doing enough as a profession, as individuals even, to address the climate emergency?
Yeah, I think I'll just reflect on myself with that question.
Sure.
And the answer is yes, I think we know to a degree. There's always more we can learn. But as to doing enough, I would say that's an easy no. And that's just reflecting on myself in my own practice, let alone practices that aren't as aware or maybe as concerned about those issues or have the freedom to take on projects that maybe don't have as onerous demands. So, for instance, like we don't do big rich houses at all, and that's because no one asks us to. But that means that we have to stick to a small footprint, and we need to be quite frugal with how we manage materials. Not saying you can't do that with a large house, but we just don't enter that area at all. But a lot of architects do all the time, and that's kind of their bread and butter, and there's a real problem with that.
Do you think in both your role as a teacher and as a practitioner that we prepare ourselves and our future practitioners correctly? I mean, that's something also FIR might have a position in as well, in terms of the school curriculum and the things that we teach people to do.
I think that sometimes with our values we do, and I think it comes down to values, but there still is this massive focus on aesthetic and what that aesthetic without the meaning behind it as well. So fashion, I suppose, would be where it comes down to a lot. And the more we can move away from that and start looking at values or meaning of aesthetic, which is more tied to things other than fashion have started to be more meaningful outcomes.
Think it's just struck with fashion fur? What do you think? Is fashion a problem that we have to overcome?
What do you mean with fashion?
Well, Emily was saying that that our profession is more driven by sentiments and fashion to do with elements like sustainability rather than the technical aspects of it. I'm speculating and extending what you said a little bit.
Yeah. I would like to start with, recent news, I think yesterday or the day before yesterday, Lacaton Bazaar.
Yes.
Won the Pritzker Prize.
Yeah,
it was so good. Had the pleasure of meeting Anne Lacaton, has been teaching in the Madrid School of Architecture for the last 20 years, and the Master of Social of Collective Housing. And it was quite a long voice 20 years ago when I was a student. Now, everybody acknowledge the qualities of Lacaton Bazaar as a practice that really cares about the environment and the economy of buildings and in a very profound deep way and a very smart way. So I think things have changed in the last 20 years, and the good news is that I don't know any architect who is a denial of climate change. So I think architects in general we are aware, we're in a part of a society which we acknowledge the problem and we try to do things. We are not doing it, we are doing enough, probably. As Emily said before, no, we are not doing enough. We can do much more. A few years ago, I did a studio here in the school about sea level rise in Perth. So I was researching some of the data available and putting the students to develop some projects in the shore and see how projections of sea level rise and rise of temperature will affect current and future developments. So I had a student that said, I've been living here for 25 years and I've never seen the sea raise an inch. So there was kind of a conversation, but I think we see a lot of people see climate change as something that is happening very slow, far away from us. I also remember some comments saying, oh, but I live in the western suburbs, I'm, away from the shore. It doesn't affect me. So I think what I felt is that a lot of us, a lot of society, in general, we feel that climate change is something that is happening slow and far away from us and it won't affect us. When scientists say, they say 2 degrees, in 100 years, that's far away, and, something's melting in the Arctic, I don't live in the Arctic, I'm safe here. So it's not enough information. There's a lot of science information, but people don't, I don't know if it's, why we are not getting the information through, and we are not getting the information through the students. I took this unit, and you remember when I arrived here, which was called Environmental Control Systems, which was a second year unit. And it was very technical, the curriculum was very technical, dealing with the specific technical aspects of insulation of buildings, like the kind of stuff that I studied when I was a student. So the first thing I did was try to change the unit and then divide it, in three parts. And the first part was about climate awareness. So I got them to watch a documentary, which is quite old now, but is still quite relevant, which is the Al Gore, famous documentary. It's probably 20 years ago or something like that. And then, have a little awareness of what is going on. Try to update that every year with the new data that is... So I think we have to start with the basics before, discussions about green or not, or, put a bit of timber here or there, solar panels, and these kind of things. I think we have to start with the big picture. I read this very interesting book from David Wallace Wells, who's a journalist from the New York Times, that compiled a lot of data from scientists. And he said that the most dangerous thing about climate change are not the denials of climate change, which is a very, you know, identifiable group of people, but the rest of us, because we feel that, you know, we recycle a couple of bins, plastic and waste, and then we put a couple of solar panels and our conscience is, you know, it's right, and we don't have to do anything else. And he's putting through that 25 companies in the world are responsible for 50% of the carbon dioxide emissions to the planet. And then, sorry for taking...
I wondered, Ross, it occurred to me that we've actually got three half generations of perspective here from, and you and I belong to an older generation that's seen...
I'm older than you, mate.
Are you?
No, really.
Only just.
Oh, heaps.
Yeah. But we've seen a change in the profession and the professional mindset. And what Fer is talking about and Emily are talking about is that perhaps the perception of climate change and the awareness of the emergent nature of it is too slow for us to take too seriously. So,
well, I think the point about the real problem is all of us, and if we put a bit of wood and some solar panels, we've kind of done our bit. But I think, you know, perhaps being a little bit harsh, but, you know, across the profession generally in Australia, that's about where the design industry is as well. And, the recent climate, the Architects Declare movement,
yeah,
that so many architects rush to sign up on, the commitments they made there, none of them have a clue. Most architects wouldn't have a clue how to meet those commitments. You know, they include circular economy or regenerative design and so forth. So the challenge is that there's a feel-good factor, like to put some solar panels on, sign an Architects Declare document and feel like you're doing your bit. But
which Zaha famously withdrew from, I think.
Yeah, well, Patrick Schumacher really set himself up in the way he dealt with that, didn't he? But... The thing is that the benchmarks we have to be going for are way beyond them. If we look at the real trend analysis of what's going on, what's in Architects Declare is probably what we should be moving to do. And I'm on National Task Force, the Institute of Architects for Climate Action, and I recently wrote a report about decarbonising the Australian construction industry by 2030, which is what I honestly believe needs to happen. And we did a proper project management kind of model of how you do it. It actually is feasible to do if you get the right momentum behind it.
Yeah.
But one of the keys to that, if we were to have a zero carbon, or a decarbonised construction industry in Australia, all architects would have to be fully conversant and capable to design zero carbon buildings. Now, for that to happen, all the schools of architecture would have to be producing graduates by then to also have those capabilities. So one of the recommendations is that if you're not teaching a compulsory certifiable course in zero carbon design or some equivalent, you should lose your certification as a school of architecture. You should lose your registration as an architect if you haven't got demonstrable capability in that, because otherwise how are you going to decarbonise the industry? So
were there targets for that in your 2030 framework? Were there targets for schools to achieve regulation?
By 2025.
Yeah.
They need to be implementing those changes to the curriculum within 4 years,
yeah,
if they're going to be producing graduates 5 years later to go into the industry and support what should be then the transformed industry. Because obviously if your buildings are going to be zero carbon by 2030, you have to start designing them in 2025, because one of the first projects, you know, 4 or 5 years to procure a project to deliver it.
Yeah.
So you've got to be, the change practice has to happen much earlier.
And what about the other associated industries? Architects, architecture schools, and the design industries are a part of a much larger network.
Yeah, well, the construction industry, and you know, the ASBEC, which kind of has overviews of this is really well onto it, but they don't have a specific target either. So yeah, it would have to be on all fronts, and it would have to be legislated. I mean, there's no way this is going to happen from a ground up, I think.
So what's the pathway to the real... Because I assume that we all agree that some kind of mechanism like that is required beyond, as you said, Emily, just sentiment. We have to have mechanisms. And what's the pathway to achieving...
Well, first, and basically, you have to write a new Australian standard for what this means, because zero carbon means all sorts of different things to different people, whether it's operational, embodied, all that kind of complications. Yeah. So you'd have to write an Australian standard, and then you'd have to get it embedded in all the construction codes, and you'd have to give enough notice so the construction industry could re-gear for it, because there's obviously a supply line issue about materials.
Yeah, the deemed to comply and the materials that are going to be used.
Yeah. But so this is something that we need to try and build momentum very quickly on.
So have you been involved in Next Steps, Ross, in terms of connecting people involved in the Australian standards, or who's got, forming tasks to do that? Are there other industry groups in that?
There are lots of industry groups, actually, which is one of the problems. It's really disaggregated and it's not coordinated.
Yeah.
But the ultimate challenge will be to get through to the government, state government and federal government, because obviously most codes are managed locally in the states. So we started, we've got the Institute of Architects adopted that report in December, there again, it sort of risks being a bit like signing Architects to Clear. It's one thing to adopt a report, it's another thing to activate it, because then you've got to find the money for the resources to engineer.
Yeah, because I've followed some of the Architects Declare websites, and because it's handled at a nation-by-nation level, in some countries it's obviously lost steam, and in other countries, I think in Denmark and in the UK, it's got a little bit of clout, and they've started moving along with initiatives like the Institutes, where they've been looking at... programs for achievable targets, but not every country has done that. So it's very, as you say, disaggregated.
I think Australia fits into that category.
Yeah.
I remember in Spain, I think in 2005, 2006, was implemented, which was a technical code for building industry or something like that it was called, but it was really referring to a kind of an early version of what Ross is saying right now. And what happens is that that was implemented by the government, and then every and affected all the building industry, not only so for example, apart from that, it doubled the work from an architectural practice, because you have to submit, apart from besides the normal documentation of a project, a thick document of 50 pages or 100 pages of that fulfilling the kind of energy requirements. But also for particulars or businesses, if you want to rent a house or you want to sell a house, you have to go through that process.
There's some gateways.
And then if your house is not prepared, you have to fix your house in order to sell it. So that will make, and then you need that, without that certificate, you cannot even rent the place.
Yeah, like a fire safety certificate.
Yeah, so that was implemented 15 years ago, 16 years ago, and I think almost every European country has something similar. And as you said, Scandinavian countries are ahead of that and, pursuing zero carbon footprint. But I'm not sure how that affected, the global, being that necessary, we have to do something else.
I wonder whether is there a sense in architects or architecture schools and people in positions like ours, both participating in regulatory change processes, but also developing some smaller level agenda ourselves. In other words, acting. Is there action we can take subordinate to that longer term goal of changing national construction codes and regulations? Is there stuff we can do already? At school level, at practice level, Ross, you're in charge of one of the global mega practices. Are practices like that doing things that are meaningful in this sense?
Yeah, they are, but not at the level we're talking about. I mean, yeah. I think there's some very, paint too dark a picture. I think there's some very good work being done by a lot of very good people.
Yeah.
But not at the level, for the most part, not at the level that the action needs to be. That's the challenge. I mean, there's a lot of 6-7 star, green star buildings and other measures that are, but unless they're really dealing with carbon as one of the fundamentals, then there's still a bit too much of a feel good factor about it. I mean, there's some pretty high performing buildings, but there's a project in that Cox did in University of Wollongong, which is Australia's only Living Building Challenge 7 Pedal Award winner. It's only one of 24 buildings in the whole world that got the Living Building Challenge Premier
Standard. The Living Building Challenge is a an association or group that develops its own standards for...
Yeah, for, and they're very, very tight. And they're not just about energy, it's about health and wellness and material toxicity, and there's a whole range of factors. One of their measures is actually beauty. I'm not sure who actually measures that part of the pedal, but they're not stepping away from the notion of aesthetic as well. But so that's a very high-performing building that Cox did at Wollongong University, and Sustainability Centre, so it's appropriate. But we need more sort of high-level case studies that sort of show people what is possible, so that architects can get enough confidence.
Is that the only one in Australia, the only project like that?
It's the premier project. I think there are two other projects that have got Living Building Challenge certification, but not at the sort of 100% score level.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think, most of the best exemplars are not in Australia, they're in Europe.
Yeah. And I wonder if that's because the European regulatory system is more unified. Is it coming from the top?
They got it much earlier. The whole green agenda was, I think it's much more of an immediacy in Europe. Air quality, all sorts of things, like China is sort of... air quality has been driving China.
Yeah. They, in fact, take it much more seriously than we do.
Yeah.
The Chinese are much better organised when it comes to this, despite their...
In this project we were talking about in Lithuania, the museum, getting A++, which is a maximum category in energy performance, was a requirement.
Mm.
So we got the first, when we were submitting, the first certificate we got was A+. And then they told us, you have to submit before December, because in January it will be A++, the maximum, the requirement. Well, we finally got A++, but it was kind of so we had to modify parts of the project to get that maximum. So it's a requirement now.
Is that a European standard?
It's a European standard.
Is that related in any way to the living building categories?
No.
Because there must be... I've done a little bit of research into these over the last few months, and there seem to be 4 or 5 quite substantial agencies that can coordinate the performance ratings of buildings.
Yeah, like LEED, for example.
Yeah, LEED.
Natters and Neighbours, they all have their own measures, but there's no coherence to it.
Have some of them, and they don't seem to produce better buildings.
They're quite blunt instruments in Australia, I think.
More sustainable buildings.
Yeah, the point scoring system, MESA point scoring system, which, put a few bike racks in the basement, is the classic sort of... criticism of Green Star that that's unfair. And Green Star have changed a lot over the years too. They've now got a zero carbon standard as well.
Yeah.
Because
that's what it boils down to, doesn't it? It boils down to how much fossil fuels you're burning at the power station, ultimately. I mean, there are a few other measures, but again, I've been teaching a little bit in this area, and so as a process of educating myself, discovered that the embedded energy, the assembly costs, the delivery costs, transport, are minuscule compared to the operating costs. And even, over the life cycle of the building, obviously. But even a building like CH4, is it CH4?
In Melbourne.
Yeah.
CH2.
So CH2 was and still is a highly credentialed building when it comes to carbon emissions, but because their building management system the computing network that controls all of the flaps and levers and misters and things that make that building work are out of date and haven't been replaced. Mm. It now performs only at the rating of a really bad 1980s building.
Mm.
So actually building controls are a really important part. And I didn't know that.
Well, they are, but it's also the factor of, you know, one of the risks that's happening now, picking up on Fer's earlier point, is there's a lot of the conversation is moving. As long as you're buying green electricity, you're okay, because technically that's a zero carbon score.
Yeah.
But really, there's still a huge amount of carbon that goes into the generation of renewable energies from solar and from wind. So there's still
The manufacturing of the panels
that's got to be dealt with there. So green electricity is good, but needing less of it is even better.
Yeah.
So driving down energy demand is in both, you know, at a domestic level, but also at a city scale, is critical.
Yeah.
So, you know, we can't just let ourselves run free on energy usage just because we've got green electricity.
I think all of us were taught energy demand in buildings by looking in first or second year of our training at psychrometric charts and climatic charts to be able to determine where energy demand was going to come and what we could do with passive systems. So passive systems have a limit. But none of us have probably ever gone back to use those charts again. I'm speaking on behalf of myself. Until we have to go and teach somebody else how to use them in second year or first year so they can forget them. So that cyclical forgetting of the technical nature is something I wonder about, whether we do need to start taking some of these things more seriously, perhaps with some new tools and new methods of learning them.
Yeah, I think, I mean, in my experience teaching that second year unit, the one you're talking about, I think one of the problems is that the design is separating the design from the energy performance of the, so that you design something based on a metaphor about Aboriginal culture or stories, or about medieval story, or about or parametrics, and then I have now to fulfill the, and then I have to make this work.
Yeah, it's a compliance mindset.
And I think one of the important things is to look at vernacular architecture.
Hmm.
So it's my old school teachers, they used to teach us, you know, people like Campo Baeza, for example, which is a guy that plays with light and and air and these basic stuff, and he used to show us like the little villages of south of Spain, Andalusia, that we, you have all these compact villages in white that you've been there. They share walls to diminish the amount of, solar radiation, the size of the windows, the cross ventilation, the shades, same thing that happens in, in the Kashba or, Moroccan villages in very hot climates. On the other side, if you look at the Scandinavian architecture, and we've been working a bit in Scandinavia lately, is the other way around. They use the earth as an insulating material, taking advantage of, protecting from the prevailing winds, enhancing the amount of lighting. Passive architecture, vernacular architecture can teach us a lot. And then, as Ross said, you don't need to, worry about the renewable energy because it's, you're using free energy, which is, which is the more, what is more renewable or green than free energy? And it has to do with a very, very simple concept. So the work of, people like, Sudhi Mumbai, for example, in India, where they work in a very humid and tropical climate. And then the way they play with the openings and the cross ventilation and the local materials is very smart and is passive and is very cheap.
Yeah, actually there's a new term, adaptive, which is the idea that we think of passive buildings that can operate as static objects with the right orientations and the right shade conditions. But then the adaptive element, when you actually have a human being who can move around, open and close things at the right time, shut things down, pull blinds, fill up water tanks or turn on the sprinklers, whatever it is they do. That kind of thing is still not actively built into our conditioning of factors that can be appreciated. It obviously involves working with client bodies. But I know that the ASHRAE group has started developing adaptive measures so that their ASHRAE standards for energy demand have now started including adaptive factors. But it's something that we as a profession don't do, and yet fundamentally we're the ones at the coalface that probably know it the best.
Well, picking up on that point and also first point, but the new Section J provisions of the National Construction Code, which Western Australia stepped aside from adopting through a very interesting process, the only state in Australia that didn't adopt it when it was supposed to last April, has some new levels of performance requirements the envelope from an energy point of view.
Mm.
And a lot of the requirements actually lead you to the kind of thinking that Fu was talking about in terms of vernacular. Because to meet the Section J requirement, you probably can't do floor-to-ceiling glass anymore in office buildings.
Yeah.
And that's kind of all anybody does anymore. It's become the absolute de rigueur in the last 2 decades.
Yeah, and the more the better.
You know, you simply can't reach the standards. Even with triple glazing, you still can't get there. And, you know, depending on the orientation, north, south, east, west, kind of going on from your point about the vernacular, those limitations change. And maybe some of the adaptive dynamics that you're talking about might, in terms of meeting Section J, create more flexibility in the design, because the current thing is you're sort of going to have small windows. You can't have big open windows. You can only have sort of, I don't know, a sixth of the facade that's got openings in it.
Is that for all climate zones in Australia?
Well, it varies for climate zones, but that's slightly overstating if I... You
know, but most of the cities would be in that category.
Yeah.
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 Sorry.
Go on.
No, I was thinking of there's a city in Iran called Jat that has these urban systems with the wind towers,
yeah.
And you can have kind of systems below with water. So playing with water, shade, and air, cross ventilation, and it's amazing how you feel there.
Mm.
So the level of comfort they're able to achieve. We're talking about 2,000 years. So it's
is that a shared infrastructure? Is that something that say multiple buildings and multiple users?
It's an urban infrastructure.
Yeah. Because that's the other thing I wonder.
Yeah, it's a city design to be sustainable.
Whether the sharing economy idea, which has so many negative consequences in terms of the economic fallout, it produces billionaires in America and paupers in Australia, let's say, but the idea that you can use shared resources, shared infrastructures, to be able to meet some of these targets might also be a necessary part of the way we have to start thinking.
It depends on scale and also density, because the strategy for a single residential house in a suburb in this country, the strategy is ultimately at the moment all you can do is really minimise the amount of energy demand you're pulling and then work out whether you can buy some green electricity. You can't do much more than that.
Yeah.
But to your point about shared infrastructure, the engineers will tell you that an optimum for kind of combined integrated energy system, combined heat and power in a city, you would have something like about 150 dwellings per hectare and an equivalent amount of office space, ideally mixed up with other infrastructure like health, education, retail and so forth, and culture. But the baseline would be a density of something like 150 dwellings plus an equivalent amount of office space, so that you don't... So you
can balance the use over 24 hours.
Yes, the 24-hour thing. So that's a model, an optimum model for an urban scale density. Like Soho in New York is exactly what that is.
Yeah.
In fact, it's a bit more dense than the 150. So there's a kind of typology that one should be thinking of in terms of cities, so that you can build integrated, coordinated infrastructure and not duplicated infrastructure. But there's not much of that kind of conversation happening that I hear in this country, because we all have to do our own thing, don't we?
Yeah, that's the cultural thing that you're also talking about, that the way that we I don't know whether your practice involves mostly single houses, Emily, but that kind of is the biggest target area, even though the companies that are producing the energy are the ones who appear to be it. The behaviour of the individual citizens or the economy in which they're functioning might be one of the major contributors to the demand, the energy demand.
Yeah, it's sort of that bottom-down, bottom-up approach, sorry.
Yes.
Yeah. It's still kind of important, even though we do have this top-down, overarching method. And just talking, I mean, 80% of our work is housing, so coming back to housing, that metric, it needs to be... We need something like that. And it's hard to make something simple and good, but we also need it to be recognised by our banks
Have you ever had a client who was so committed to addressing climate change that they've actually insisted on it as a part of their brief?
I haven't had anyone who's come to me and said, I want a
zero carbon house.
No, but it's always been a factor of people that come to us now, thankfully. But not in an extent where that is the core part of the brief.
Yeah.
It's just secondary.
I only had one, it was me. I just built a place down south, but which is, you know, off grid, generates its own electricity and power and water.
Are you living there?
Yeah.
How's it working?
It's working pretty well.
Yeah.
Still sort of tuning it. But I think that there isn't a massive amount of demand side. I mean, there are large developers in Australia who've got a pretty impressive agenda in the current context, like Lendlease and Mirvac. I mean, yeah. they set their own projected standards because they've got fairly much control of their own terms of reference for development because they do them themselves. So, you know, there's some pretty impressive performance outcomes at Barangaroo, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done some pretty good work around waste management as well, but their supply chain work that they did to achieve those outcomes were really, really impressive. I think the real... So where's the leadership going to come from is the ultimate question. And I don't think, as architects, we should wait for clients to be pulling us into that space.
Yeah.
I think we have to develop the knowledge and skill sets to be pushing or taking clients with us into that space, because they may have, you know, they may have a moral, ethical basis for doing what you're asking for, but until you get momentum and a kind of tipping point of all this, it'll still be not the norm. But if architects can become fully conversant in the technology and the practicalities of high performing buildings moving towards zero carbon, and fully understanding the whole embodied carbon world, which is really complicated, of course, they can help clients get there and show them the way, and show them in a way that doesn't cost them a fortune to get there as well. But you mentioned earlier about tools, and it's interesting that, what's the title of the series, Digital something or other?
Local Code.
But you said it was Digital or something.
Digital Design Journal.
Digital Design Journal. There are a lot of very good digital tools emerging now. And ultimately what we need to be doing is doing a life cycle assessment of projects. So if the project's going to last for 40 years, what's its carbon footprint for that operational, as well as the upfront energy in building in the first place? And life cycle analysis is very revealing, and you can sort of re-engineer it into a life cycle design approach, coming back to your point about you know, designing that way rather than trying to retrofit the performance on the back of a design that's come from
as a compliance idea,
developed from some sort of local cultural factor or landscape. One of the more interesting tools that I've come across is called eTool, which is developed in Western Australia by a guy named Richard Haynes. So, you know, it's here. But architects need to be fully conversant with the use of that to know how to anticipate the implications and design it, so they're not just waiting for an engineer to give a result each time they design. So design one, engineer response. Design two, engineers, you know, keeps sort of telling you what you need to do. But unless you set it up from the beginning, both with the engineer but also having the developed knowledge yourself to lead it, architects are in the best place to lead this issue because we set the agenda from the beginning, building on the first point again. So we need to accept the responsibility for the climate emergency, acknowledge that we have a key role to play in that, and then start training ourselves up for it.
How would you characterise the leading role that architects have in the industry? I mean, this is a question for all three of you. Because there are people who have already pronounced the death of architecture. I meet many people throughout the Asian region who say that architecture as a profession won't exist, though the practice will exist, but it won't be conducted by this group of institutionalised, bow-tied, bespectacled, professionals.
What a loss.
Hmm?
What a loss.
Well, no, these are architects saying this, not barbarians. I just wondered how we, is this a real fear about our relevance in the profession, and do we need to start learning carbon economics instead of economics, or theory perhaps needs to be grounded in a different place, so that we can, are we still people who lead the way in, to some extent, and other parts of the industries look to us for leadership? What do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. I think there's different levels of leadership. I think, for example, I'm going back to the Pritzker Prize. It's very good news that in this matter, for climate awareness and carbon footprint, to give the award to architects like Lakatan and Lazar because of what they do, what they've been doing. And also coming from vernacular architecture, they studied in North Africa, then they moved to Paris, learning from that vernacular architecture, implementing greenhouse technology into housing. And also what is very interesting about them is the awareness of the economical aspects, giving you more for less, let's say, giving you an extra space, an extra... so this is kind of setting leadership. It's not the same, awarding Lakatan Basada, a very formal architect that does very expensive buildings. And, it's another message that you send to the profession.
Yeah.
But another thing that I try to tell my students is that and related to your question of the lack of relevance of architects right now and the loss of our leading role, if we ever had one, is that it's a selling point. I mean, if you tell a client that you're going to save money by, designing, having this kind of design instead of the other kind of design, then it's a selling point. It's not just telling them I'm going to do something that is beautiful or something that it looks, stunning and, this kind of more, superficial words, but telling them that you're going to save money and you can show them how much money they're going to save,
Because it does seem that we've entered the world of consumption with our products as advice packages. We are consumed by consumers, by clients. They seek us out for our value, and perhaps this is the fashion element that you were referring to, that people seek out the best architects, but that very rarely includes the sort of performative aspects that Lakatan and Vassal promote. And I wonder whether even just the way that we appear, once it starts to incorporate these new operating systems, might be a part of the path forward for the profession and for the industry as a whole.
I think one of the, architects clearly bring something to the world that doesn't come from other practices, sources. Perhaps that's what they mean when they say the practice will, but not the profession.
Yeah. Sure. I think architecture won't disappear.
Yeah.
But the knobs who promote themselves.
Yeah.
Since the Bauhaus was offering advertising as its one of its core units, and they had to study advertising.
Well, the challenge for the profession really is that the world has got more and more complicated. Buildings have got more and more complicated. Not only from the financial procurement side, but also the complexities of delivery and construction and so forth. The challenge for architects is to keep up with that and keep a leading, contributing role to that. And I think the way I look at it from my stage of career is that we've become a bit technically lazy because of it being complicated. We've handed off more and more of that to others, so the control of those factors have gone to others.
Through mechanisms like design constructs and so on.
And, you know, the development industry, when it arrived in town, is the usual story. You know, we gave up the control of the finances of the project, and the quantity surveyors and developers came to town.
WA are world leaders in that
exactly.
area.
Australia's definitely a world leader in that. But, you know, I think that if we're up for it, now's a kind of golden opportunity, because the technical digital tools that are becoming available, if the architects want to go to the trouble of embracing them, learning them, applying them, employing people within their practices who can apply them, they don't have to all be doing it themselves. There's heaps of young people with fantastic skills in these areas. Then there's a chance to sort of get back to the centre of the table. It's not about control. It is a bit about leadership, but it's not necessarily about power.
Yes.
One needs to think separately about those things a bit, I think. But with these skills, one can be at the core of the conversation, helping direct the traffic of the outcome, including what I was saying before about educating clients on what's achievable with projects if we are ourselves fully conversant with the practice of zero carbon design. But there's a challenge for the schools in this, particularly in the age of diminished funding, because this would require the schools to really step up in a much more proactive and assertive and maybe even compulsory way the learning of the technical side of the practice of architecture. And it's not left as an option. I mean, in a sense, I'm a little bit out of touch with education now, like I used to be in the old days. So I don't really know what's going on, but I sense we sort of gradually moved more and more into it. Do your own thing, select your own courses, design your own stream of your education degree. And very little is compulsory. And that's like saying there's no core to the practice of architecture apart from design. The brilliance of what it is one has uniquely to offer as a special talent person. That's what's continually celebrated too much. And I think if you put that brilliance and skill alongside a mentality of being a service to the communities within which we practice, then the balance between our responsibilities shifts a bit, I think.
Good point.
I think, you know, following Ross' point about education, maybe it's a bit outside the topic of today, but I think schools still are too focused in the beauty of drawings. So drawing as a, you know, design is related to drawings, and drawings as the main element. Mm. So the goal of the student is to have this amazing drawing.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And then, but then the drawing is you know, is about the graphic skills of the students. And I think education should be focused more about ideas. I remember read an article a few years ago about the future of the profession of architecture. They said, it basically said that 80% of the current practices will disappear. It will be the only two models surviving would be, because the drawing thing would be done by kind of like a robotic kind of practice. Then you will have always the craftsman, the kind of architect that, you know, remote, that lives remotely and work for the community, that this is a minority of the architects. And then the big multinational practice, it has to be reshaped into a kind of think tank and work with policy and, you know, cities and with a global agenda, local and global. So the whole thing in the middle, just all of us, will disappear. Because it's no longer necessary. What do you need an architect for? If you can, you know, people don't hire architects anymore.
It's an interesting point, because I've been running a unit called BIM Authors, which is the building information modelling software tool that we use. And as part of the assignment, I gave the students a template that I developed to make beautiful drawings, because it does it automatically now. And all of the projects look beautiful. But funnily enough, you can still interrogate the ideas behind what you're saying, so that the drawings themselves still look great, but the architecture itself is actually very transparent, because you're looking at all of the same drawings that are exactly the same. So it actually evolves exactly what you're talking about. So that robotic methodology, if you will, coming out of the software packages is making very apparent what's wrong with the actual
building or the idea, which I think is actually kind of cool.
There's something really important to mention, I think, and that's not, drawing isn't just something you put on at the end. Like, beautiful drawing comes from technical skill. So maybe we're just moving our technical skills into other areas. You can't be a good designer if you don't know the technical aspects.
Yeah, there's no question in the period that I was educated, the advancement of what we called culture. And then, after Ross came to our school, the questioning of the values underpinning culture under the assault of things like feminist critique and postmodern critique, post-colonial critique, those sort of things transformed the importance of culture in architectural practice. And we were designing buildings that were perpetuating ideas of culture or exploring culture. And it seems now culture is threatened. Even Peter Frampton said it in his latest edition, or the most recent editions of his Modern Architecture book, was that the climate change is the big thing that's changed the entire game and the meaning of culture. And so culture now has to be relativized in terms of survival.
It does have to be the priority. I mean, this thing about the disappearance of the middle ground of practice from boutique, for want of a better word, and sort of the large mega practices. The advantage of a large practice, and I have experience in that, obviously, is the resources you can bring to a question. And they can be in-housed. If you know, we developed a computational modelling group. It was 13 of them just doing that, about analysing performance of buildings, both in fabric but also behaviours of people and all that kind of stuff, just to inform, that you're going to design a building that's going to work better for the users, whether it's a university or a hospital or whatever. And so I think there is, with the right-minded approach, there is a lot of value to be gained from a large practice. So, for example, Perkins and Will, who I think are a good, solid global practice, one of the top five, largest five in the world, I guess, they recently announced, I think it was this time last year, that from now on, I'm not sure if it's the whole practice, it was just UK where it was announced, when commissioned, they would always give two designs, one that was the design as their brief, and the other was carbon neutral. And they'd give it for the same fee. So clearly they had the capabilities in house to be able to, yeah. But, imagine the cost if they weren't set up for it. So, really brand defining, but also showing some leadership in it, sat in the context of Architects Declare, as in their other practices that, the Rogers practice of all. Lots of them have said that, by a certain date they won't take commissions that don't allow them to do a zero carbon design. That's carbon neutral, that's the term they use, because that's one of the problems about what it means, zero, neutral. It probably mean operational, and probably involves offsets, which is the other complexity about
Perkins and
Will.
Perkins and Will.
Yeah.
I just wanted to make sure it was clear in case our listeners wanted
to ring them up.
Mum?
They're a curious practice. I think they're owned by a Lebanese wealthy person.
When
they took over the American practice, and they've been growing, not quite exponentially, by acquisition. This isn't an organic growth model. It's a merger of acquisitions growth. So but they've seemed to have done all that and maintained a decent level of quality of practice anyway.
They bought a few Scandinavian practices, right?
They tried to buy us once. lots of people tried to buy us, actually. It was interesting. That's such a crazy phenomenon, all that. I don't think it needs to be I don't think it needs to be about mergers and acquisition to create a critical mass to do, complex work. But I think in terms of, where the spectrum sits from large to small, the pressure is going to be on becoming specialist. I mean, the big practices become all-encompassing generalists to do anything at a highly technically resolved way. Smaller practices, in my view, will have to become more and more specialised to survive, because that'll be their point of difference, and there has to be a point of difference.
Yeah, you're right in finding that, actually. Yeah. But I need to really jump onto that thing that the client thinks I am. I think it's better for me and it's better for the world.
Yeah, and then you can then afford to develop the skills that sit around that specialisation, not having to deal with all the complexities that exist everywhere else.
Yeah.
So But you know, there's some really good examples and signposts. There's a firm, I think they're Netherlands based, Rau and Thomas Rau and Sabine Oberbrau, is it? They've just recently done a building for a Trivios Bank, which is Financial Times' most sustainable bank in the world. I'm not sure what their measures are. But this building is carbon positive. But the really interesting thing is that they've produced it with a, what they call it as a... Anyway, the building's been built to be dismantled, and all of the materials and components of the building have been rescheduled for their reuse. And they approach it as a materials bank for the future. They don't, there's nothing to do with, you know, demolition and landfill and all that kind of stuff. The whole of the building has been set up for its potential repurposing and adaptability, but also for dismantling.
It's assembly and reassembly.
Yeah. So
that would take a lot more thinking and planning, wouldn't it?
Clearly they've been on this for some time. But Sabine, I think, is in charge of the kind of business model around this and the accounting. So they actually changed it's actually a signpost for a different way that buildings are accounted for as an asset. Because obviously the current thing is you write a building down in terms of your asset value on your accounting books. But this way, because they've set up the database for it from the get-go, they've got a permanent record of potential asset values of all of those elements, which can be refreshed and reviewed as the years go by, and that can be on the balance sheet as well. So it's a very holistic way of approaching the problem of carbon, and coming up with part of the solution is about a different way of accounting.
Does it extend to housing as well, or is it primarily offices and institutions?
It's all about how you put a building together, so you can pull it apart and not throw it away.
A lot of that happens in Japan already. They have a systemic thing, and I know that they're the practice of the architect, because the infrastructure, the superstructure, needs to be so earthquake proof that they've come at it because of that.
They've always been that way.
Yeah.
So the whole thing about the circular economy, no waste, zero, waste is becoming so expensive in Europe that it becomes a big motivator for approaching it this way. So coming back to the earlier points about, green building, sustainability, your first question, ultimately, if we're serious about this, partly because of the finite nature of resources, we have to be thinking about, that we can't just keep throwing things away. The classic example everyone uses is the world is running out of sand for concrete. We export sand to Singapore. We dig up sand here and send it to Singapore so they can make it into concrete, because they've run out of islands to demolish, all of the concrete. And Singapore was coming from the little islands around the place. The beaches of North Africa, the rivers of India, riverbeds of India are all being mined. Sometimes it's black market stuff for the sand, for concrete. Even sand is a finite resource, because they kind of...
They banned clay bricks in China.
Yeah.
Because they need the alluvial soil for food production. So they're going to need to find alternatives. They've been using concrete in the interim. I've been reading this... a blog called Critical Concrete out of one of the universities in America about how the future of the replacement for concrete is one of the most important concerns of the construction industry.
Yeah, I mean, there are all sorts of avenues being explored, including the recycling of concrete.
Yeah.
Obviously, lower carbon processes for its manufacture. Mm. But one of the advantages of concrete in the life cycle assessment process is that it lasts a long time. Mm. So when you do a whole of life assessment of a building, it actually starts scoring up again compared with other materials.
Well, this is probably a topic for another session, but the critical concrete gang, including a guy called Gary Kuhlmans, who sounds very much like an Estonian, I think, looking at concrete and doing research on the lifespan of concrete, because he maintains that architects have bought the myth of concrete as being a long-lived material, but the reality is that unless it's produced in particular ways, it isn't long-lived.
It isn't. Yeah.
And the reality is that it lasts 50 to 70 years, and yet we continue to perpetuate this myth. And actually, a lot of architects' practice is based on
perpetual myths about architecture because we feel connected to Vitruvius and to Pericles.
Do you?
Not me in particular. But I heard you were a good fan.
I'm not quite that old.
I think that brings an interesting topic related to demolishing versus preserving. I think going back to
Lacaton
is a night of violence.
Yeah.
And I'm surprised how many, you know, the demolition process, how often happens versus this culture of preserving and retrofitting and renovating.
Repurposing.
So it's it's proved that demolishing involves waste, involves transport of materials, involves is a less sustainable practice than preserving.
Yeah.
So that, I think that is an interesting element to consider.
Yeah, and it certainly seems to be the catchphrase that has captivated everybody's imagination about Lacaton and Vassal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've seen, been watching blogs around the place, people, architects saying, don't demolish anything, is the kind of catch cry now that they seem to attach to.
Don't do anything.
Yeah.
Well, no, it's
doing anything. Yeah, that's been my
It's interesting point. Because as the unit coordinator for the design studios in the master program at UWA, I've been involved in selecting staff. And one of the things which I've always found interesting is that Nicoletta Prizzi works with us, and she's a heritage architect from Italy. And so she's been doing projects with the students in the West End in Fremantle to repurpose buildings and to try and make them more relevant by using the existing stock. So for the first half of the semester, they do heritage studies through the, the Borough Charter. And then the second half of the studio, they do sort of half a design studio. So it's a 6-week design program. And in actual fact, at first, it used to get quite a bit of criticism from other staff in the school because it wasn't a proper design studio. And I found that kind of interesting. But I think now Nicoletta's work has been fantastic. And a lot of the students who have done her studios have gone on to become heritage thinking architects, which I think is a really good thing. So that's one thing that's happening in the school, which I think is been a positive in terms of trying to understand what the existing building stock means and how you might use it in the future.
Yeah, we probably have to uncouple or decouple the notion of heritage from it.
It is true, yeah.
Yeah, I think that it has to be put right at the core of this whole agenda about, you know, finite materials, carbon, and measuring the value of buildings differently.
Somebody I saw on the Critical Concrete website a concrete substitute that's being developed with organic materials. They've been looking at mycelium, which I'm sure you're aware of, and also potatoes, which is a nice secret.
The Local Code podcast has been brought to you by Solargain. Solargain has been in operation for over 20 years now. When you're looking for solar, go with someone who stands that test of time. Call today on 1300 739355 or simply go to their website, solargain.com.au.
Into the hot topic. Yeah. Okay. So the last part of the segment is called the hot topic, where we get to taste test really hot chips.
And try to decay that.
Well, the last question we were going to talk about is other experts, who are the other experts in the construction industry?
Just checking.
Going to be interesting. So I have a real aversion to people eating when they're on the telephone.
No, I know.
And so now we're going to be eating when we're sort of on the air.
I know, it is really annoying too. It is horrible.
It's deliberately so.
Actually, put these on and listen.
It's going to look like an American movie.
No, I think it'll be the edit point at which the thing is ended. All right. As soon as the chips got open, that's the end.
Okay, so the Pringle Passport flavours, Szechuan style chicken flavour, are not chilly at all.
So we're going to have the conversation about the experts, or we've already finished?
We're going to do that while we try and have...
I think we should do it.
Are you guys not going to eat chili chips?
Oh, I'll try one. It's a chili.
It is.
Yeah.
The Cornetto peri peri style nacho crisps do have a little bit of bite to them, and they're gluten free, which is also good.
Gluten free, or what are those things?
They're quite nice.
No, chili indeed.
Apparently, the Cheetos ones, the flaming hot Cheeto ones, are the hottest.
Can you deliver the rest of the leftovers?
We'll eat them at waste. Okay, I'll give them to the students. Oh god, these look disgusting.
Wow.
Refuse to eat those.
You could just lay them all out and you'd have a model.
Yeah, so the Cheetos Flaming Hot are hot. They're hot? Too hot.
Too hot?
How are they? Yeah, everybody's gonna try one. Come on.
No, I can't do that.
What about these ones?
Stick to the Pringles.
These are the kettle chili with jalapeno red chili. These are probably the hottest ones.
But back to this question about consulting. Do you think we need to start incorporating as part of our practice other industries and other professions that we must consult, that we must include in our, even in our determining of our own pathway? You know, is it something that we can do alone, or do we have to consult others, not only in the delivery of services, but in the preparing of ourselves?
Sometimes I think about, I guess experts are great in other fields, but what people I know who have an architectural training that have gone on to specialise in a certain field, what they can bring is actually amazing. I can think about Daniel Jan Martin, who's like been studying water for a long time, and the stuff that he can teach other architects is just so beneficial, because maybe because he just gets it from a design point of view, and also because the research he's doing has so much, he's already thinking about it in terms of application. But it's also like really holistic as well, thinking in a really broad picture. Whereas I think a lot of experts, they're great, but they would have a fairly narrow skill set, whereas designers, architects have a really broad skill set.
I think that's our advantage. You know, we deal with a whole project, and hopefully things beyond that, including things like water, which don't appear to be part of our domain, which clearly needs to be. I'm back to a previous point. I'm very encouraged by the potential for the kind of digital platforms and tools that are emerging, and there's no reason why architects can't be embedding those in their practices. And, you know, the students that come out these days, a lot of them have some terrifically developed skills, and you know, a lack of inhibition about approaching a new software platform to learn it and use it. And this e-tool, lifecycle assessment tool I mentioned before, currently the guys that produce it consult, because most people don't have the tool and don't know how to use it, so they use it as an external consultant. But there's no reason why that facility couldn't be picked up by a relatively young, gung, digital character in a practice, learn it and apply it, and you've got it there in the mix all the time, so you can be understanding. And the key thing from it is the learning of the implications of design decisions on carbon. You know, it's what to move beyond the iterative one. Well, we've done a design, do the assessment, do another design, do another assessment. You know, if it's embedded, I think there's a greater chance of learning how to design better in that stream from the beginning, to take account of the things that need to be taken account of. But if you're constantly relying on an external consultant, that limits that, I think.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, we will go through a period of significant reliance on engineers and other, you know, digital guns. But if we seize the opportunity, then we will embrace those things. And you know, that group that I've built inside Woods Bagot, just the capacity for informing and elevating the quality of the performance of the buildings we were designing is amazing.
I've also read about the people who design most software are engineers.
Yep.
And increasingly now we're getting architecture-minded people going into software development and software design. And the point of view that they were talking about was the influence that engineering thinking is going to have even our architects, because we use these tools that were designed using engineer workflows, engineer systems thinking, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but there could also be potential for the participation of design thinking from an architectural perspective that could go into software development. And exactly how that's happening, it sounds like in groups, in firms like the Woods Bagot, that was happening.
Yeah, it was, but you know, there's a terrific local example of two youngish guys, they're probably, you know, Tristan Morgan and Daniel Griffey,
I think is
how he's pronounced
it. Giffrey, yeah.
Giffrey. They helped me with a series of lectures I put together recently for architects on zero carbon design, funnily enough.
Mm.
Which is now being picked up by Engineers Australia. They want to rerun it for themselves, which is also rather nice. So Tristan and Dan did one of the talks, and they actually built a software platform, as they do, cobbling together other, you know, like you need parametrics, you can put all sorts of programs together to give you the outcome. And illustrated, you know, the carbon and water outputs from a design as you change the roof structure concept from a beam to a truss. We shifted the spans, and therefore the member sizes changed and so forth. But a whole range of other parameters that they were dialing in, and it's almost real time because you're working within a BIM platform where you pull things out, you know, take things, you know. I don't know if it's actually Revit they were working in, it could have been not a full BIM platform, I'm not sure. But so there are young guys who do that, and to your point, Ramesh, they do it by cobbling together different software packages that can work with each other to do it.
Yeah, well, interestingly enough, now the architect, when we're talking about it in context, is the primary author of the model, the 3D model of the design work. So their role in the overall understanding technically of the digital role of a model is becoming really important. And so guys like Tristan and Dan have been really good, I suppose, at championing those practices in the kind of parametric way. But funnily enough, it still seems to be kind of like a side concern rather than something in the centre. Surely with the Revit models now that you can get, all the ArchiCAD models are fully ready to use as you were sort of saying, as a tool to be able to understand almost precisely how the building's going to perform on a day-to-day level, but also as a life cycle project. Funnily enough, I've been working in the Masters of Building Information Modelling here at UWA with the team that built the latest RSL building in town, which was a fully compliant BIM utilised building, construction and design, which is now going into facilities management. So with the facilities manager's possibilities of the 3D models that they have, and once again the architect was the one that created the first part of that model that's now being used for facilities management. So that's kind of an interesting development in terms of how digital platforms have actually started to re-inform how processes might work in the construction industry.
Well, facilities management, software development, we've already talked about education, three future topics for the Local Code podcast. I just wondered, as a way of wrapping up, each of you could suggest a topic that we could pursue for a future podcast. Sorry to spring that one on you.
That wasn't on the list.
No, it wasn't.
Perhaps we should make the
space. You don't have to.
But we can cut it. We're thinking about starting a journal club, funnily enough, which we're going to distribute a journal article for discussion as a topic, as an online thing. Because the other thing that I find too is it's very hard to get hold of information, very hard to find information that's specific enough to be useful that goes beyond the basics. You know what I mean? So we're thinking that once a month we'll do a journal article that will distribute get a discussion and then hopefully get an online platform where the discussion can continue for the following month.
I think I'd like to hear like more specific topics. This is just me. So
yeah.
Like between the concrete, if we could just hear about concrete or just hear about adaptive reuse or even like narrative, because this is so broad and it's great, but we don't really get into any deep topics. So it'd be nice to like maybe just a focus on just housing or just like.
No, it's a good point. And I suppose as the we have thought about some of those things, and I suppose as a pilot we were thinking more broadly it'd be good to get some more broad pictures first before we start to drill down.
Yeah.
And exactly that, we were also hoping that the contributors would give us kind of new topics or feedback on what topics would be good. So that's a great one, Emily.
It depends a bit on your audience as well, doesn't it? Because, you know, there's all sorts of things run through one's head in response to this, in the context of this conversation. But, I probably tend to think more about, you know, what the profession could do with. I mean, you know, and that, you know, there's a, what's it called, the database of material carbon that Melbourne University produced. I forget what the name of the platform is. But anyway, they've created a complete database of materials for measuring carbon, which is what people like Tristan and Dan use when they plug into their modelling tool, so you can read the carbon and the water output. And, you know, that's a fantastic piece of work, and by all accounts pretty, pretty valid in the kind of way it's built up. But, you know, it takes account of transport, where the materials are sourced from, the footprint associated with that. It's not just, you know, it's a piece of timber or it's a piece of concrete or it's a piece of glass.
For the Melbourne market?
No, it's for Australia.
Right.
Yeah.
But and it does it by brand or something. Is
goodness knows how they build it. There's a topic, but it's probably
yeah.
You know, I'm not sure if the audience is interested, but we should survey the audience. But you know, Richard Haynes, the eTool guy, his database is more of an international one, and he's got his own reasons for, you know, the differences between why he's chosen it. But that in itself, you know, how does
the e-tool, what's it called?
E-tool.
E-tool work?
You have to have a BIM model.
Oh, right, so it works out of BIM.
Yeah.
Man, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Seriously.
Yeah, so, you know, BIM knows what's there. So then you just plug it into the database of what the carbon is for all the bits that the BIM already knows about.
Okay.
And it gives you a number. You change the bits and you change the number.
I might get his details from you.
Good luck with contacting him. He's very busy, but I think he's doing terrific work.
Yeah.
No,
because you know Autodesk, this will be off record, but Autodesk has dropped the ball on their entire platform, pretty much.
Because they bought EchoTech, didn't they?
Yeah, and then I think now that Andrew's left, it's going to bits and it's falling apart, and it's falling apart so badly that we can't teach it anymore.
Yeah.
So we had students trying to use their software package, and it didn't work, and it was giving us the results which were wrong, which we knew were wrong. So we've been looking for new versions of software that we can use, and it seems they're a local.
Yeah.
That didn't make more sense.
Just there in Sherwood Court or whatever it is.
Yeah,
but also, you know, again, picking up on first point about the field of factory recycling and putting some panels on the roof. But the whole world of waste management, you know, if we feel good about, because our newspaper, well, probably don't have newspapers anymore, but our cardboard and our glass and our plastic's getting recycled, what we think it is that we're doing what needs to be done. But the whole world of waste and waste management and driving towards what a real circular economy needs to look like is itself a very interesting topic, I think. And maybe of interest to your listeners, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think so. You know, I've been in contact with Cuthbert Curtin, the Centre for Sustainable Practice, I think, or Curtin University for Sustainable Practice.
Yeah.
And they have a waste management expert there. And I'm surprised that the School of Architecture, the design school, doesn't incorporate some of that stuff into its training of architects rather than keeping it. Perhaps it's a timing thing. It just seems like such a central and important discipline.
I think the discussion within university schools of architecture about what position they're going to take in this context is really, really important, because there's a great diversity of the way it works across the country in different schools. And I think, you know, that it's not like an Architects Declare Act, because I worry that that was often so hollow in terms of the way many architects declared. I hope I'm wrong. But, you know, universities should, or schools of architecture should state a position.
Should declare.
What their position is in relation to the climate emergency, and what their strategy, you know, what their priorities that come from that, having made that, you know, in a fully informed way, and what the actions need to be. Now, probably going to be very uncomfortable for, you know, because of the way courses tend to be structured these days. But it's pretty damn important.
Ross, is there an exemplar in Australia that you can mention in terms of the architecture schools?
Well, I haven't. Was one of the projects of our task force is to actually undertake that work, and there is a bit starting. But, you know, I think there's some very good work that New South Wales has got. Guys like Dave Prasad, who's a real leader in this
field. That's where Dan Coolman's is as well.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, they've been doing good, serious work, and Deo, in my recent, I got to know him recently through that task force, and he seems to be a fantastic thought leader in this field, and he's been committed to it for a true believer. So they may be amongst the better ones, I don't know.
Because you would say here at UWA, it's probably an informal decision by staff, and the value system you were talking about, and trying to avoid being fashionable in a sense. So it sort of happens here at the University of WA as a kind of like an informal thing, but it could easily be formalised, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, what I feel is that we are very soft in general. Not the architects, not the architecture school, the university, and the citizens in general. So climate change is a real threat. I mean, the pandemic of the COVID is nothing compared to one of the thousand pandemics that can happen when the temperature rises 1 degree or more. You know, is heat, is starvation, is war, is immigration, like, so it's proof that a raise of 2 degrees can multiply by 10 the amount of war in the world. I mean, Syria, all the conflicts are related to climate. So there's a studies that says that. And then all the migration processes, and, you know, is you know, and these COVID is, you know, as I said, you know, all the tropical insects and diseases that can, you know, travel upwards, you know, the permafrost holds double of the carbon dioxide that is currently in the atmosphere, that can trigger 86 times the global warming, and it's just
and anthrax.
Yeah, and anthrax as well, but anthrax is the keynote. So it's really, and then even meeting the Paris, you know, accord, you know, is not enough. So the scenario is like terrifying if you read a little bit, and it's depressing. But what I feel is that everybody's looking to the other side. It's like, okay, I'm doing my bid, you know, my conscience is cool. I just another day, I'm going to buy another house. I'm going to, you know, where. So, but the prospect, so I don't know if it's a, you know, the human nature to look to the other side, or is that the people controlling, you know, the companies that control, really, you know, it's a money business, it's a power, it's government, and it's, you know, and it's so powerful that the grip is so big that, you know, in reality, you know,
but it's an interesting point, because I think part of the idea of Local Code, the podcast, is to actually start to understand and help people be able to take action. And I think that's an interesting point, because, you know, solar panels, one, and I might say, because our main sponsor is SolarGain, who are solar panel installers, so I'm going to say this outright, that putting solar panels on is a form of action.
Absolutely.
And it's a start point for people to start to understand even their energy, because one of the things that comes with your solar panels is the energy assessment of your own house, because you then get all of the monitoring tools. So in a sense, you become acutely aware of how much power you use, when and how. And I found also having a country property, a bit like Ross, with having a water tank, you start to understand your water consumption as a family and as an individual and how much you can pot, so to speak. So the interesting thing about the water that we have today, I think these are around about $2.50. Our water, by the way, our water was brought to us by Ningaloo Blue premium water today. But the fact is that you can buy water in the country for around about $200 for 10,000 litres. And that's the same companies that buy the water that use bottled water. And then if you add the plastic that comes into the bottled water, the whole picture starts to shift very quickly. But then that thing about what do you do to help with this climate change thing, it has to start with small things that individuals start to do to shift the whole way of thinking. Because I think it's going
to
be a...
So it has to start, I mean, and all these things, and, you know, toilet paper, we started using...
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you know, all these little things come, of course. But I think we are too late. It's too late for that. So it's that's for sure,
yeah.
But it's too late for that. If we just do that, even if you know, each of us we use recycled toilet paper and, you know, and water and everything, the earth, you know, is in a serious threat.
That's
and not in the next 80 years, but in the next 30 years or even, you know, this winter in Madrid, there was a snowfall. I don't know if you saw the news, with sleds and dogs and people skiing in the city. With more than 1 meter of snow. I can show you the photographs.
Yeah, I did see.
Yeah.
The biggest snowfall in more than 150 years in the city. In Lithuania, they reach, and in Siberia, they reach like 37, 40 degrees in summer.
Wow.
You know, melting ice caps in the Arctic. So it's really happy. I mean, bushfires in Australia and California.
Five of the sevens. World's seven major climate systems have started changing, and that's sort of why we, with the decarbonizing the construction industry, decided, you know, when you look at all the details, the construction generally is around 25%, some would say 30% of the problem, buildings and construction, then that's a big chunk of something to tackle. And if you can decarbonize that, then you've made a material impact, albeit it's Australia. And we chose 2030, partly because of the emergency, but partly because it's within sight. So, you know, the thing about it, the problem is somewhere else.
50 is too far.
50 is too far away. 30 is only 9 years away, but the critical actions are only 4 years away. So, you know, it will be amazing to be seen if we pull it off, but some of the motivation was around trying to get a focus and get people around a target that was in, you know, a 5-year plan kind of thing. That's, you know, it's material, it's manageable. Businesses work that way. Governments sort of don't, but do. So that's, you know, kind of trying to move the game away from, you know, toilet paper and recycling plastic. Because that is what it's going to, it has to be moves of that scale to have any impact. It is too late. I mean, it'll be interesting to, when the real momentum gets in the Western Antarctic ice shelf, you know, that's going to raise, that by itself will raise the sea level around the world by a metre, that one event, and it's already started to move.
I mean, we see the effects of the pandemic about, you know, in the GDP of countries, just 1 year.
Yeah.
What happened? Yeah, it's 10%, 15%, 20% in some countries. A drop of GDP.
Mm.
We're talking about double that with climate change. So the countries that will lose 50% of GDP. So we're talking about serious stuff here.
Yeah, but it still comes down to the point is like, what do you do? Like, you know, what is enough? What isn't enough? And I think that's the question.
I think the model would be, you know, the model would be between the, you know, toilet paper and solar panels and Greta Thunberg.
But so, maybe it's just about...
Well, I think Greta...
Yeah. So it's policy. It comes to policy. Mm-hmm. And it comes... It's not the same, you know...
yeah, but government's decided by society. And society has to make those decisions. And how does society become aware of the climate emergency as we see it?
I mean, in Germany, the Greens, the Greens are ahead in the polls right now for a reason.
Are they? Yes. I thought they just got kicked out by the bloody marijuana party. Didn't I hear in
there's another voice
here.
Green.
That was here.
That was here, yeah.
Sorry, Ross.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think I think we can, being a bit more optimistic about it, we can, our profession is ideally placed to be at the vanguard of changing policy, to lead that. We're in the middle of what happens in the construction industry, and it's every reason, if we decided to be bothered, that we could be the ones that change the policy and the codes. But typically, that isn't the way the profession thinks. I think my sense is the profession waits for those changes to come to it and then works out how to accommodate them, or in the case of Section J, rejected in Western Australia. I mean, that reputation in the rest of the country, when that happened, was just completely shot. So we can do it, we just have to decide to be bothered, but it's complicated. And there's a lot of people to be influenced, but step by step, it's like any of these things, if you break it down to a series of small steps, then it's each step is easier.